ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For 80 years, America led the liberal international rules-based order. Created at the end of World War II, the rules-based order is a set of ideals and institutions designed to prevent military conflict, promote free trade, and support human rights and democracies. But today, these ideals and institutions are being challenged as never before.
In light of numerous actions taken by a number of bodies of the United Nations, which exhibited deep anti-American bias, we have an executive order that would withdraw the United States from the UN Human Rights Council, would withdraw the United States from the UNRWA. More generally, the executive order calls for a review of American involvement and funding in the UN.
Today, America is withdrawing funds from a myriad of international organizations, while at the same time, President Trump is disrupting the global economic order by imposing tariffs across the board. Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince, and in this Rear Vision is the liberal rules-based order that has underpinned international relations for 80 years about to collapse. And if so, what might it mean for global security or the global economy? And who is to blame? Can we simply blame Donald Trump? Or are there deeper forces at play? International or regional orders, that is an accepted understanding of how nations or powers interact or trade, have existed forever. Isis Zarakol is Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge.
We tend to think that international order is a modern creation, maybe post-17th century development. To some extent, that's true, but as I've argued in my book, Before the West, you had world orders before: trade connections, shared institutions, shared understandings of sovereignty. In my book, I talk about 13th century to 17th century and focus on Asia, but you could take it back even further. All the way to antiquity, people have had orders, and those orders have flourished and then fragmented, and maybe that's what we're going through now as well.
Yes, I mean, diplomacy has been around a very long time. Trade has been around a very long time, and there had to be rules that govern both, and to be sustaining, you had to observe them and you had to keep to them.
George Lawson is Professor of International Relations at the Australian National University. He explains that our modern order of codified rules emerged in the 18th and 19th centuries.
I think what's different is not so much the existence of diplomacy or trade or rules around war, but the thickening of those rules and the formal way in which they're managed and governed. So the emergence of modern international law is actually codifying a lot of practices that had been around a long time. So if you go back to the treaties around the end of the Napoleonic Wars in Europe, for example, you get a codification of practices between at least some European states, what are considered to be the great European powers, who agreed not to intervene in each other's affairs, again, in a way that as an idea and as a norm and as a practice had been around a long time, but became now an explicit diplomatic practice. And then in the second half of the 19th century, you get the emergence, particularly at the beginning, of regional international organizations of various kinds to solve what were increasingly sort of functional problems. How did you deal with the increasing transportation or trade or postal services or whatever it was? So you had an increasing set of international organizations, in some senses global, sometimes around the Euro-Atlantic space, sometimes a bit further afield than that, that try to solve functional problems. I guess before World War I, perhaps the most important indication of this are the two Hague conferences, one at the end of the 19th century and one towards the beginning of the 20th century, that establish rules on war that, again, states largely keep to for the most part, or at least can be held legally accountable for if they don't.
The push for even greater formalization of international relations emerged after the horrors of World War I. It was led by US President Woodrow Wilson, who argued for open diplomacy, economic free trade, and the creation of the first international institution, the League of Nations, all of which was to prevent another global conflict. Charles Kupchan is Professor of International Law at Georgetown University.
It failed in part because the United States, and the U.S. president was in some ways the brainchild, refused to enter. The Senate voted three times on whether to participate in the League of Nations, and three times it said no. And that's because even though most people living today don't know much about America before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. was basically isolationist and unilateralist and wanted to go it alone. And Woodrow Wilson was in some ways the father of what we call liberal internationalism, but he couldn't sell it to the Senate or the American people. In fact, Wilson, even though he didn't run in the 1920 election, called that election a referendum on internationalism and America's role in the world. And he supported a Democratic candidate to support this idea of an America that would stand by partners and build international institutions. And the Republican candidate, a guy named Harry Harding, he said, I campaign against Wilsonian internationalism. I stand for the founding fathers, against all entangling alliances. He won in a landslide, and that really began the American retreat from the globe that we saw during the 1920s and the 1930s. So the League failed in part because the world's most powerful country said, we're not going to play. And it also failed because when push came to shove, and Italy, Germany, and Japan went down the road of fascism, Nazism, militarism, there simply wasn't enough willpower among the key players to stop the aggression. And so it wasn't so much that the League failed, it's that status quo powers failed to come together.
But in 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, attitudes in America changed.
Prior to U.S. entry into the war and the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there really was a consensus in the country to go it alone and to stay out of the affairs of Europe and Asia. And then December 7, 1941, was really a turning point, an inflection point in American politics, in which the president, Franklin Roosevelt, puts together a bipartisan coalition behind what we now call liberal internationalism. And liberal internationalism really, I think, has three planks. One is that it's liberal and that it's based upon democratic government and rule of law at home. Two, that it supports open trade, free trade. And the economic nationalism of the 1930s was seen in part as a cause of World War II. And so there was a desire to kind of roll back protectionism and open borders and see commerce flowing freely around the globe. And the third plank was multilateralism, formal partnership through institutions. And the UN and the UN system was initially seen as the core of that. And in many ways, it was based upon the same structure as the League of Nations, except the UN had American participation. But because the Cold War came on pretty quickly and the UN Security Council, which is divided among the great powers because they all wield the veto, in many respects, the key institutions that emerged were not global in scope. They were Western in scope. And so NATO, the various alliances that the United States formed in East Asia and in the Middle East, the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, these ended up being the main pillars of an architecture that we now call the liberal international order.
The U.S. role was crucial. When World War II ended, the U.S. represented half of the world economy, and that's because the war had devastated Europe and strengthened the United States. That American share of the world economy goes down to about 25% by 1970, and it's remained at about 25% ever after.
Joseph Nye, professor in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University.
But the most important point was that the U.S. spent a good deal of effort to try to strengthen Europe and to develop Europe so that you'd have a better distribution in the world economy. At one point, there was even talk about including the Soviet Union, which would have made it more of a world economy. But the Soviets decided no. Stalin felt that if the Americans had entry into his economy through monetary policy and trade policy and so forth, he wouldn't have the kind of absolute control that he wanted. So that's why it became a bifurcated world economy. People talk about a liberal international order. It was half the world. China and Russia were not part of it. And so we did have the institutions of Bretton Woods, the IMF, the World Bank, and so forth, the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade, which did produce a degree of order in the world economy. But the world economy was half the world, not the whole world.
As well as the two economic blocks, there were also two security blocks, the Soviet bloc and the US and its allies in the Western bloc. And what went on within each bloc remained within that bloc.
Yes, I mean, that was possibly the most important component of it, because it allowed states within those particular security alliances to intervene. So the most obvious example would be the Soviets intervening in East Germany in 1953, in Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia as it was in 1968, under the guise of the Warsaw Pact, because that was within their security architecture. It was slightly more complicated on the Western front. And then you take various wars, then very often they were lined up as particular blocs. So Vietnam, I think, is the only American-led war that the British didn't support. The Australians did. I think they've been loyal every single time within that Western security architecture. The Brits, probably the second most loyal. They missed that one, but otherwise have been there every time. And you had lots and lots of proxy wars where around the world, these blocs lined up, sometimes covertly, sometimes more explicitly, behind their particular side. So that would be true of Cuba. That would be true of Ethiopia, that would be true of Angola, it would be true of Afghanistan. So a lot of the global Cold War took place through these blocs and then through their alliances with particular local actors who were very good at actually finding spaces within these alliances to do their thing. The only thing I'd add to that is you can't read it off as a straightforward West and East story and you're either in one block or another. Because not only did you have that movement from below to recognize global humanitarianism and so on, whether it was the anti-apartheid movement or movements against anti-racism or various indigenous rights, there was also the emergence of a non-aligned bloc. I mean, Bandung there establishes, if you like, a third way. It's probably not the right term. Probably people there would hate that idea. But the idea was that you were neither East nor West.
Looking back, do you think that architecture played a role in ensuring that, say, conflict didn't break out between the Soviet bloc and the United States and the West?
Now, to slightly rephrase the question, you know, where did the West and its institutions and its norms most matter? And I think the answer is internally, that it created a space of prosperity, of rule of law, of mutual respect, of solidarity that was really quite remarkable. And it did build a community of sorts that went beyond just common interests based upon common values, which is in part why NATO and the West kept on ticking even after the Soviet Union disappeared. I think that when it comes to the relationship between the West and the East, between the US bloc and the Soviet bloc, there were some norms, there were some rules, but not a lot. There were discussions about arms control. There were discussions really beginning toward the later part of the Cold War about how to preserve peace, and détente emerged in the 1970s. But the bottom line is that if there's a dominant explanation for the absence of war between the two blocs during the Cold War, it's nuclear weapons. I think it's safe to say that had nuclear weapons not existed, the Soviet Union and the United States probably would have found themselves at war.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince, and we're asking if the liberal rules-based order created after World War II is disintegrating. At the beginning of the 1990s, the Soviet Union, its trading bloc, and its military alliances collapsed, leaving just the Western rules-based order dominant.
Then at the end of the Cold War in the 1990s, the United States and its partners basically said, we won. Democratic capitalism has prevailed against autocratic communism. And as a consequence, we will now universalize the liberal international order. And that really began an experiment, bringing Russia into the G7, bringing China into the World Trade Organization, expanding NATO and the European Union. This was all about, in many respects, attempting to do for the rest of the world what partnership, multilateralism, democracy had done for the West.
The collapse of the Soviet Union led to what some people call the American unipolar moment. There was no large country to balance American military power. And in that sense, there was a belief that in that circumstance, you could develop a stronger UN, stronger international institutions. Obviously, that didn't last.
In the 1990s and the early part of the new century, I guess you could say the terrorist attacks of 9/11 kind of ended that period of optimism. But yeah, there was a real headiness during that period that the Berlin Wall metaphorically was coming down. And the UN, which had been hamstrung by the veto, which had been deployed hundreds of times during the Cold War, now could become the global body that it was meant to be. And in fact, you saw fewer vetoes during this time. You saw the United States working together with the Russians and the Chinese in some instances to try to deal with conflicts, for example, in the Middle East. Balkans, a little bit more complicated because the Russians were supporting Serbia. There was nonetheless a kind of optimistic view that we could make this work. We now are back in a world in which the UN is sidelined, and that's simply because great power rivalry is back. And whether it's Ukraine or Gaza or anything else, you're not going to get a consensus in the Security Council. So veto means paralysis. That having been said, I think it's important to keep in mind that on a day-to-day basis, the UN is doing incredibly important work, whether it's peacekeeping, delivering humanitarian assistance, its various specialized agencies are sharing information, the World Health Organization and pandemics and healthcare. But when it comes to the big geopolitical issues of the day, when it comes to war and peace, when the great powers are mad at each other and vetoing resolutions, in many respects, the UN gets sidelined.
As the West attempted to expand its liberal rules-based order, non-Western nations began complaining that they were either being excluded from this high-powered club or, if admitted, that their concerns were being ignored.
The liberal international order has universalist claims. It's supposed to be for everyone, but historically it's functioned more as a club that you aspire to get into. It has, you know, exclusive membership to some extent associated with the West. I think one of the complaints was, as you know, it was trying to expand and other countries were aiming to join and in some cases officially, formally joined these institutions. It wasn't as inclusive as it had advertised itself to be, that, you know, the countries more in the semi-periphery, more on the outs, felt that they weren't getting proper treatment or they weren't being let in. And that became, you know, kind of an undercurrent.
When you peel away the various layers of the liberal order, it's an order that was constructed for and by a certain group of countries, and it was constructed to serve their interests. And so it's difficult to untangle the liberal order from American power and purpose. And if you do look at free trade, at globalization, the global South benefited, in some cases handsomely, and in other cases was exploited. And if you were to say, well, what's the balance of power in the IMF or the World Bank? Who calls the shots in the UN? Well, it's still the five powers reflecting the global distribution of power in 1945. Hey, folks, it's 2025. Why isn't India a permanent member of the Security Council? What about emerging powers in Africa and Latin America? What about Brazil, Nigeria, South Africa? And so I think we're in a period of history in which there is a growing sense of agency in countries that feel like they have been objects of the liberal order rather than participants in it. And we're also seeing, because of that, a proliferation of all kinds of different groupings that in some ways are seen as alternatives to the Western order. The BRICS grouping, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB. There's this kind of proliferation of institutions that are in many respects trying to root around the global institutions and the regional institutions that grew up during the era of Western hegemony.
The demise of the Western rules-based order, however, isn't coming from outside, but rather from within, from the United States of America.
Of course, then an actual threat to the liberal international order, surprisingly for the field of international relations, came not so much from the outside or the semi-periphery, but really from the core of the order. The United States, the primary champion of this order, is now the primary force for its unraveling.
Both the global financial crisis and the American War on Terror played a role in undermining the liberal rules-based order. But Charles Kupchin argues that the seed of the demise was laid in the 1990s.
The demise of the order, or the weakening of the order, you can sort of trace back to the 1990s, even before 9/11, because I think that part of what's happened here is that there was excessive optimism about the ability to universalize the liberal order and to democratize through free trade. And it turns out that sort of letting the market run wild and bringing China into the WTO in the long run not worked that well for workers in the United States and in Europe and in other liberal democracies. As a consequence, we're witnessing a backlash against free trade and against globalization because many citizens feel left behind. And that sort of dates back to the heady period of the 1990s, where I think we spent too much time figuring out how to universalize the order rather than how to consolidate the order.
I teach this module in Cambridge on the crisis of the liberal international order. And, you know, we do the triumphalist moment in the 1990s. And then the next step is, you know, the war on terror and global financial crisis. We can blame, of course, what's happening now on Trump. But in some ways, you know, the complaints about the liberal international order or its association with U.S. hegemony and the grievances there started in the early aughts. On the one hand, you have this idea of multilateralism, but, you know, war on terror showed that the United States was quite willing to act unilaterally and violate, you know, international law when it suited United States purposes. So there is an undermining of legitimacy of the arguments for this order. Then, of course, the global financial crisis hit the United States and Europe more severely than it hit other places. So it created domestic grievances against globalization, which is, of course, associated with the liberal international order as well. And it caused influx of investment to to places outside of the global north, which I suppose was in some ways good, but it also helped the democratic backsliding in those settings by giving free credit to aspiring strongmen.
9/11 initially, in some ways, was a boost to the West and to solidarity, and NATO allies and Australia and other partners played roles in the post-9/11 wars, whether it was in Afghanistan, Iraq, the counter-ISIL campaign that emerged later. But I also think that in those wars, you began to see the roots of an American backlash against strategic overreach. And in some respects, the Trump phenomenon, both this recent win, but also his first term as president, was in some ways a reflection of a primal scream in the American electorate. And that primal scream was too much world, not enough America. What about us? What are we doing trying to build schools in Kandahar when we need them in Kansas? What about my job on the General Motors production line that I was making $35 an hour unionized in the good old days, and now I'm making $12 an hour at Walmart? This kind of sense that we outsourced our jobs and we spent trillions of dollars trying to turn Afghanistan into Ohio, it was a fool's errand, and it's enough. That in many respects is Trump's brand. The erosion of American internationalism, the sense that the United States needs to pull itself back from the world, the protective tariffs that are going up as we speak, these are all signs of an inward turn in the American electorate. And that inward turn is in many respects shaking the foundations, if not destroying the foundations, of liberal internationalism in the world that America built after World War II. And the big question I think that many of us are asking in Washington is, what is Trump going to do after he finishes taking a wrecking ball to the world that America made? Is he going to put something else in its place? Or are we all just going to be left standing in the rubble?
I think, you know, part of it is kind of the natural flow of history. Solutions that we find in one period don't work, so they need to fall apart, so we find new solutions. I think in the best case scenario, this is like a short period of disorder. The strongman trend is a global one, but at the same time, there is a lot of resistance globally. You know, not everybody's happy with this already. Many people are turning away from these types of leaders. There are protests. So maybe from a short period of disorder, we emerge with newfound respect for democracy and multilateralism and so on. That would be the best case scenario. I suppose the worst case scenario is that we enter a long period of disorder, uncertainty. But, I mean, the good news is, if you study long durée history of international relations, order always reemerges.
Professor Isez Zarakol, author of Before the West. My other guests, Professor Charles Kupchan, author of The End of the American Era. Professor Joseph Nye, author of Is the American Century Over? And George Lawson, Professor of International Relations at the Australian National University. The sound engineer is Hamish Camilleri. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on Radio National. That's the last of our summer series. Next week, the first of Rear Vision's 2026 programs. And this year, I'm taking a step back, so you won't hear me on air every week, just occasionally. But I'm leaving you in the very capable hands of Anthony Fennell, who most of you will know has been presenting Future Tense. So he will be shifting his gaze back in time, as opposed to forward. And Ros Bluett, an experienced producer-presenter from the History Unit, who you may have heard on Rear Vision a couple of times last year. I couldn't think of two more experienced people to leave you with. Thanks for listening over the last 20-odd years. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.